This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to Pressing Matters, the show where we go behind the headlines and explore issues driving the press. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. Indonesia has become one of the countries in Southeast Asia hardest hit by COVID-19, second only to the Philippines in the number of confirmed cases. It has been one of the countries that opted against a national lockdown in order to preserve the economy. However, as the number of cases continued to rise, was this really the right move? Joining me on the show today to provide perspectives on how Indonesia is tackling the pandemic is Yohanes Nugroho, a writer and political analyst based in Surabaya. Welcome to the show, Yohanes.
Thank you. Hi. Hello.
Now, Indonesia has the second highest case count in the region and the highest number of deaths so far due to COVID-19. I think the latest count is at over 150,000 confirmed cases and some 6,500 deaths. In light of all this worrying data, what's the mood on the ground in Indonesia with regard to the pandemic?
Well, I think people are catching on, you know, because lots of people didn't believe in the pandemic before. They thought it was something like a hoax or conspiracy. Lots of people actually believe that. I actually read a post by a man in Surabaya about 2 days ago. He said that he didn't believe in it at first until his father-in-law died of it. So I think people are catching on now. And there's a bit of a panic mode within the government as well.
Why has Indonesia been relatively slow to realize or respond to the seriousness of the virus?
We started late, I think, because the government was insisting that there was no such thing, you know, there was no pandemic or there was no outbreak in Indonesia. During January and February, we had all sorts of government officials saying things like, oh, no, it's not going to reach Indonesia, you know, our climate is tropical, you know, the sun rays will kill the virus and things like that. And I know that they were probably worried about the economic impact of a lockdown or a pandemic. So they were trying to probably calm the people, but I think they went about it in the wrong way. You know that the Indonesian government hires sort of social media influencers. They're there to work for the government, you know, and they were spreading misinformation about the virus. Things like, oh yes, there was a foreign conspiracy to force the Indonesian government to declare a lockdown and then the economy would be crippled and things like that.
Right. I understand that the question of whether or not a lockdown should be enforced became a very partisan discussion on social media, in part due to the rhetoric of social media influencers. And turning to the issue of COVID-19 conspiracy theories, which you mentioned earlier, I have to say I was surprised to learn that these kinds of theories have gained quite a lot of traction in Indonesia. And you wrote about this in a recent article for The New Narrative. So why do so many Indonesians believe in COVID-19 conspiracy theories?
Well, I think one of the issues is that people really don't trust the government. I mean, this is true because people in Indonesia have always believed that the government is telling them less than it should be, you know, telling them. So in a way, it's understandable. I mean, this has a long history, basically. Going off the track, for example, in the 90s when President Suharto was still in power, you know, when his wife died in 1996, I think, the official version was that she died of a heart attack. But then people started coming up with conspiracy theories, you know, oh, no, she died in a firefight, you know, because she was trying to come between the two sons who were shooting at one another, things like that. So people, Indonesians always believe there's something more to whatever the government is saying, you know, that they're being lied to or something. I mean, that's the general mentality anyway.
What are some of these theories being bandied about and how widespread are they?
Well, it's pretty common. I think if we're talking about class divide, then the lower middle class and the lower classes believe in the conspiracy theories more, I think, because, you know, they're not seeing any government action that's helping them. Many live sort of hand to mouth. You know, they can't really earn if they don't work. And if there's a lockdown, of course, they can't work. So that's the reality. Many people in Indonesia believe that the COVID-19 epidemic was a sort of a conspiracy by big companies, you know, to squeeze more money out of the people. And in a way, it's also, it doesn't help that the health industry is, it has a really bad image, bad public image, because the general idea among the people, if you go to a hospital, then they're going to bleed you dry. I mean, it's true in many cases. I mean, I've had experience myself, you know, when if you have to be hospitalized, especially in a private hospital, they will try to basically inflate the size of your bill, you know, even by getting you to do unnecessary tests and unnecessary therapies. So the health sector in Indonesia has a bad image and people don't really believe it. That's why people don't really want to go to the hospital unless it's the last resort for them, you know, it's the last thing they could do.
So in your article, you wrote about Jerynx, a drummer with an Indonesian punk band who has become known for supporting and propagating COVID-19 conspiracy theories. Could you tell us more about Jerynx? How is he involved in all this? And why is he proving to be so influential?
Well, he's a celebrity and lots of people just you know, listen to him because he's a celebrity. He's quite well known as a musician and his Instagram account has 1 million plus followers. So he's quite well known. I mean, even in the social media post that I mentioned earlier, in which a Surabaya man admitted that, you know, he initially believed in the conspiracy theories, he also mentioned Jerynx, you know, he was basically following him as well. The thing is, Jerynx was seen as a man of the people because, you know, he was voicing the concerns of ordinary Indonesians about, you know, what restrictions would mean for them economically and things, and then the health industry, you know, which is seen as being too greedy by many people.
I understand that the most recent development is that Jerynx has actually been arrested. Was this for spreading misinformation on COVID-19?
Well, not because he was spreading misinformation. He was arrested because in one of his posts, he called the Indonesian Association of Doctors, IDI, a lackey of the World Health Organization. So he was basically being sued for defamation. Well, that's the ironic thing, I think.
How has the public reacted to his arrest?
Lots of people are supporting him, especially in Bali. You know, he's Balinese, and people in Bali, I think the majority of them are sort of saying that, you know, it was really, you know, it's compounded the whole idea about the conspiracy thing, you know, because, you know, Jerynx was speaking on behalf of the people and he was arrested, persecuted for it and things like that.
And I suppose Bali was one of those places that is especially hard hit by the halt in tourism.
Yes, exactly.
So everything is sort of compounding each other. The economic crunch is compounding the spread of the conspiracy theories without the government, I suppose, coming in trying to set things right. And people don't trust the government anyway, so it's a bit of a catch-22.
It is indeed, yeah.
I'm speaking to Yohanes Nugroho, a writer and political analyst based in Surabaya, on how Indonesia is coping with the pandemic. When we come back, we'll discuss some of the economic repercussions of COVID-19 and how the government is tackling them. Stay with us, BFM 89.9. Hello, I'm Shazana, and you're listening to Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. Today on the show with me is Yohanes Nugroho, a writer and political analyst based in Surabaya, and we're discussing how Indonesia is dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. So, Yohanes, Indonesia didn't enforce lockdowns to the extent of Malaysia's movement control order or Singapore's circuit breaker.
Yeah, that's right. Not to the extent that to what Singapore and Malaysia did, but there were partial lockdowns, you know, partial in places, but I don't think they were effective though.
And when you say partial lockdown, what does that mean? And how did it end up affecting people's lives and livelihoods anyway?
Partial lockdowns meant that there were certain cities, usually major cities in Indonesia, like Jakarta or Surabaya, you know, people weren't allowed to travel in and out of the cities. And then businesses were encouraged to shut down. And, you know, we had policemen sort of raiding cafes and places where people gathered and things like that and told them to go home. But the problem was social distancing was not really practiced, though. And it's really difficult to practice social distancing in Indonesia. In urban centers, lots of people live in very small streets and it's just it's just impossible because everything is so crammed.
Was there any attempt by the government, though, or health officials or health organizations to emphasize the need for physical distancing, or how about in terms of...
Oh, yeah, I mean, there was a campaign. There was a national campaign by the government. But the problem was, I think the message didn't get through in most cases, because at the same time, government officials were also, they were saying different things, basically. They were saying contradictory things, you know, things like ministers saying, you know, even the health minister at the time was saying, oh, no, you know, we should rely on prayers. And then what's happening now, the Ministry of Agriculture has put out this product, you know, it's like an anti-corona necklace. It's like herbal medicine, but they're saying that, you know, it works, it prevents infection. So, yeah, I mean, the problem is the government's message is just too confused, I think.
And even without a lockdown, Indonesia's economy has suffered. In the second quarter, it contracted by about 5.3%. How is the government responding to the economic crises? What's being done to cushion the blow for the everyday Indonesian?
They have put out measures, economic measures to... allegedly to contain the economic impact. But then it really doesn't address the larger sector of the economy, which is the informal sector. So at the moment, we have this scheme of cash transfers from the government to workers. But then they're only doing it for the formal workers, you know, not the informal workers. Because the prerequisites for applying for this grant or for this transfer is that you are in the formal sector. You have to have a, you know, a tax number, and then you have to have the government's insurance and things like that. And it's, the thing is, most people, most workers in the informal sectors, sector don't have it. And it's not going to help the majority of workers. So I think it lacks realism.
You wrote an opinion piece in the South China Morning Post very recently, highlighting the impact of COVID-19 on informal workers. I think you cited that some 60 to 70% of workers in Indonesia fall within the informal sector, which is a huge chunk of the economy. Why is the informal sector so large there?
Yeah, that's a good question. But then the thing is, most workers in the informal sector, they earn sort of really low wages, really. They sort of scared of dealing with the government. You know, they don't want to register themselves with the tax office, although actually they're not going to pay anything, you know. In Indonesia, if you earn under 5 million, you don't pay any income tax. But then most people are sort of wary of dealing with the government. And also, the thing is, most small businesses, well, they can't afford to pay their workers the sort of the minimum wage. And our law allows that condition as long as the worker agrees to it. So if a worker agrees to being paid less than the minimum wage, that's okay. And that's the essence of the informal sector, where workers get paid below the minimum wage.
At this stage, is there data on how many people have fallen into poverty due to COVID-19?
No, but then we have the statistic on unemployment. We've just had additional 2 million or 2.3 million or something people out of work. And it's expected that 10 million will be out of a job by the end of the year. 10 million in the formal sector. So there could be another 10 million in the informal sector or something. But I mean, I know it's difficult to gather statistics on the informal sector because it's a transient sort of sector. You know, people sort of move from job to job and they don't really work on a permanent basis and things like that. But it is the largest sector of our economy. So
now there's this law that's being discussed at the moment called the Omnibus Law, which is touted as a means to create more jobs in Indonesia. So given the rise in unemployment, do you think that this would be the time where the Omnibus Law would get more support?
I think they'll probably manage to do it, the government and the parliament. But it's a controversial law because lots of unions are against it. And, you know, the law is controversial because it's going to curtail some of the rights that Indonesian workers enjoy at the moment, you know, in industrial disputes and things like that. So I mean, it's well-intentioned, I'd grant you that. I mean, but I'm not sure if it's going to be beneficial. It might be beneficial for companies, for large companies, but probably not for the workers.
Would this proposed bill help informal workers?
No, it's, I suppose in a way, it encourages people to join the formal sector, you know, workers to go into it. Yeah, that's probably the only thing. But it's, no, it doesn't address the informal sector, really.
What do you think the government should be doing to help the informal sector?
Well, I think they should at least try to come up with a scheme to, you know, to encourage people in the informal sector to take out small loans, you know, to maybe they can start small businesses and things like that. And also the problem with Indonesia is that the government doesn't have the data, the necessary data to map out all the areas in the economy, sort of, so which families need the most support, and, you know, and which areas are the most economically deprived and things like that. So I think better data management. The welfare data is out of date and they sometimes get it wrong. So, for example, in some cities like Jakarta, they had government handouts, goods, you know, food and things like that to allegedly poor families. But then in many cases, the poor families didn't get any handouts and, you know, middle-class families got them. And it was really confusing. And local officials insisted that their data was correct, but it wasn't.
And looking towards the longer term, President Jokowi, in his State of the Union address a few weeks ago, said that the pandemic can provide an opportunity to reimagine the future economy of Indonesia. What do you make of these comments in the context of what the government is doing so far?
Well, I think the speech was written for the domestic audience. You know, in times of crisis, the Indonesian government likes to pander to our sense of nationalism. I mean, basically what he was saying that, our economy has contracted by 5%, but we're still lucky because, you know, countries like Germany, France, and the US contracted by 17% or something, which is unrealistic because the Indonesian economy is in no way comparable to that of Germany or France. I mean, it's a different type of economy altogether from, you know, from Europe, for example. So I think it was just talk. I mean, I don't think there was any substance to it. But he did say that, you know, it provides us with an opportunity to catch up with the advanced economies. But that's not really, really realistic, is it? For example, foreign direct investment plays a major part in the Indonesian economy. The largest foreign investor in Indonesia is Singapore, followed by China and then Hong Kong, you know. So if those countries are in a recession, you can't really expect them to invest in Indonesia, can you? So it's not that simple. I mean, he was trying to simplify things, whereas the reality is really quite complex.
Complex indeed, and we'll be watching how this situation plays out, both in Indonesia and within the ASEAN region, as we all grapple with the post-COVID-19 reality. Thanks so much for sharing your insights with us, Johannes. I've been speaking to Johannes Nugroho, writer and political analyst based in Surabaya. You can read his latest commentaries in the South China Morning Post and the New Narrative. This has been Pressing Matters on the Morning Run. We have the 10 a.m. news bulletin coming up next, and then Enterprise will take you through the rest of the morning. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.